Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the AMWA Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The AMWA Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have Zach Callenborn, who is a friend of NucleCast. He's been on, it's been a while, it's been at least a year or so, but Zach is, of course, our drone expert extraordinaire. You know, he writes, if you've not read his work, Zach, Z-A-K, Callenborn, it's phonetic. Go look him up. He's got a lot of great articles and reports, so you got to read his work and follow him. So, Zach, welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got we sort of have a thread that we're going to pull today in our discussion, and we want to start with California's SB 1047, which is a bill in the California legislature that is about artificial intelligence safety. So could you give us maybe a little description of that, and then we'll start pulling that thread?
Yeah, exactly. So this is a law that came out of California. It got vetoed just about last month. I believe it was September 29th. But it reflects a larger trend of significant interest around AI, and particularly the concerns at the intersection of AI and chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. A big element of this bill was trying to establish safe, mandatory safety and security audits and requirements on some of these artificial intelligence models. And specifically, it was narrowed to what are termed frontier models, basically the really high-end ones where you're using large amounts of computers and large amounts of data to train these things. So, you know, the more potentially scary ones. And so what's gotten a lot of people's we'll say underwear in a bind, is that they're concerned about what AI might do for larger proliferation and access to these weapons. You know, the scare is that, you know, a future bioterrorist will go on to ChatGPT or, you know, whatever version you have in the future and be like, hey, how do I build a bioweapon? And it'll spit out precise instructions. Of course, you know, there's various security measures and there's already various safety things that, you know, you can't go that explicit in the at the moment, the chat will just say, you know, well, that's illegal. We can't do it anyway. But even in theory that you can work around, there are ways to work around these things. But the concern is, you know, folks will find those ways and that, you know, this AI will be so smart and so intelligent that, you know, it'll teach those of us who don't have any chemistry or biology background, like, how do I make one of these weapons and in a very technical and precise way? And so that was kind of the idea of the bill, but ultimately it did get vetoed for a variety of reasons. There was a huge falderall over this particular bill. There were folks on both sides all over Twitter, all over the news, pushing some for, some against, especially against were many of the AI companies. But it wasn't a pure, you know, company versus other folks like Nancy Pelosi and other prominent political leaders in California also were against the bill. And the concern was, you know, that we don't just know enough about some of these risks and how realistic is it that, you know, we can use AI to actually build some of these chemical and biological weapons. And that was particularly my concern, as I was one of the folks opposed to it, relatively minor one compared to all the others. But, you know, that's definitely, it's an open question, how much risk there actually is, you know, to actually work in a bio facility and make some of these things actually really hard. So how much do you actually get out of the AI system? And so, you know, the companies were understandably concerned that, like, you know, we're having to adopt all these new security, all these safety measures on something that we're not really sure what exactly is going on here. And there was enough, you know, vagaries in the law that folks were concerned that, you know, an angry prosecutor who just doesn't like Facebook or Meta or whatever for some particular reason, or Google, or, you know, is like using this law as an excuse to persecute and sort of address some of the, you know, just go after the company. So there's a lot of sort of concerns, but, you know, for certainly this discussion, we can focus on some of those, you know, larger national
security. Well, don't we have a lot of product liability law, you know, already on the books that we can say, hey, listen, if you design a product and that product, you know, if you take a look at like, you know, the COVID shots, that we had a federal, you know, law that alleviated those companies from having any liability. So it took an act of Congress to say you can kill people and you won't be liable. But yeah, without that, you know, they're liable. So wouldn't these companies be sort of, you know, careful with what they design for the sake of the fact that they know that they can be sued and that lawsuits can, you know, depending upon who gets hurt and how many and all that, they could be in the millions and tens of millions of dollars and essentially, you know, destroy a company. So is there not an incentive to somewhat be careful already?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that was part of the, you know, concern that these companies had. That said, that was also an argument that people in favor of the bill were making. It was like, okay, these liability laws are already accepted. And all this is really doing is reminding people of these, you know, what already exists. Then personally, I have to wonder, well, if all you're doing is reminding it, why do you need a new, you know, legislation to do that? But I tend to agree. And part of the issue that I saw with this as well is, you know, how broad it potentially could be, you know, because we think about enabling a CBR on attack. There's a lot of things that go into a CBR on attack. It's not just, you know, getting that weapon system itself. You know, you could imagine, for example, using an AI deepfake to try to get access to someone's system or just a minor, you know, as part of like an intelligence reconnaissance type thing to scout out a potential target and use AI in that way. So if that ultimately led to a CBR on attack, would that company be liable? But at the same time, like creating just a video of, you know, me or you or anyone else is not exactly a, you know, super advanced capability. And so I think part of the issue was that, like, the law didn't really specify very well, like, which parts are the real concerns here when it comes to enabling these types of attacks.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I've been reading some of the books on COVID and the COVID pandemic and how it took place. And so, you know, the wisdom now is that this was in fact, you know, created in the lab in Wuhan. That's the, you know, the intelligence community's accepted wisdom now. And we know who patient zero was, who was a gain of function researcher in the lab. And so as you were talking and explaining this, I was thinking, well, you know, we have this project that is funded by Bill Gates that's, you know, going out around the world, climbing into bat caves, trying to find every vaccine. They're going to find every virus in the world, bring it into labs, and then they're going to manipulate it in gain of function research so that they can then develop, they're going to make it dangerous so that they can then develop the vaccine for it. That's the whole, this project that Bill Gates is funding. And then of course, a lot of these viral designs are, you know, they're on the internet, they're publicly available in research, in published research. And so if AI learns by what it can find on the internet, then our effort to go out and find and then, you know, manipulate viruses to me would essentially, and which of course is then public, your AIs that you're talking about would then be able to go do the very thing that we are afraid that they'll do because we've created the research and made that research public that they then go in and use. And to me, it would, you know, it's just sort of not a well thought out program you know, AI would inevitably go and find that information because it, you know, as it crawls the web and incorporates information and learns and, you know, that's these large language models and all of this, you know, the learning tools that they have. So I can you really blame the AI for doing what AIs, you know, are essentially designed to do? Or do we need to demonstrate some, you know, better control in other areas? Because I think we understand artificial intelligence and how it works and what it does and why it does that. And then doesn't it become more incumbent upon us to, you know, do a better job of sort of wrangling it?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there, and I have to say you're kind of sounding like one of the so-called doomers of where AI is, causes this mass proliferation of bioweapons. You know, I'll say that definitely, you know, that's I think a big part of these folks' concern who've really been pushing this law. That is, you know, you're bringing in information like gain of function, and then you can sort of use that. And I think there is a genuine concern there that we should be worrying about that. Part of the reason why I'm somewhat more skeptical is that there's so much of biology is really the skills that come from working in the lab itself. And there's only so much really you can get from just simply sharing what's written down. My favorite example is personal. It's a bit silly, but I think it illustrates these points. So I took a microbiology class when I was I think it was high school, undergrad, something like that. And it was, a 9 a.m. thing, and I was absolutely awful at it. I did okay at the test. I think it was, B's plus, maybe an A minus every once in a while, but I was absolutely terrible at the lab. So much so that, I literally set multiple fires. My worst part was at one point I was working, and then I dropped a glob of bacteria on my notebook, and I didn't notice it. And then I came back to my dorm afterwards and then found it, like this dime-sized glob of bacteria on my notebook. And then about a week or so later, my dorm mate got down with a pretty bad case of a staph infection. And we were working with staphylococcus in the lab. I don't know that it's my fault, but the point being is you shouldn't need an AI to tell you, don't set fires, don't drop the stuff. Now that's a silly example, but more largely, many of the skills that folks work in the lab, those are things that you can't really get the textbook for. We know from biology research in general, from reports back when we, had the weapons program, folks would point out that working with a new agent was actually really hard because the skills that they had developed in working with other types of, like plague or whatever, didn't readily transfer to working with, I don't remember what it was. I think it was like Marburg or something like that. And, there may be ways that AI could help that. If we think about automated biological equipment where the AI does, just takes over and does that thing. So I don't need to worry about dropping the bacteria, the AI does that. That's possible. But part of the challenge is I don't think we understand well where these risks are, and we weren't necessarily testing for them. We're not thinking about them. That said, in the future, I think we will, absolutely. Actually, I think it was just yesterday, the White House signed a new national security memorandum on AI. One element to that, which I think is a great idea, is developing some classified testing things where, you probably could actually, and you may even be able to work with the real agents in some of these particular cases, since we have some of that, as part of our biodefense program. I think it's so long story short, I think there's definitely some risks there and we need to work on understanding them, but I don't think we do yet. And so jumping to a lot of regulation and legislation is maybe not the best idea.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you on that one. I do wonder, if you think about, just think about government in general. And I was trying to think about that one problem that government solved it with, laws and regulations. I can't think of what it is. I mean, I can't think of anything, any problem government solved with regulation. So the question that the idea that, and, to say, well, AI is the problem and therefore we need to regulate it and stop it when in fact that might not be what the problem is. But I do, if you think about, thinking about terrorism, because I think a lot of the concern is large states like China or Russia, they can do this. They've had large biological weapons programs. They have the skills. But if we think about, terror groups, I just finished reading the, I don't know if you've heard of a guy, Masab Hassan Youssef. He was the son of the founder of Hamas. And he was a, they called him, he worked for Shin Bet, the domestic spy agency in Israel. And he was called the Green Prince. The books are great. If you've not read them, he tells the story of how he got involved. But at any rate, he talks a lot about the Hamas, terrorists that he worked with. And the funny thing was they were all engineers because they had all gone to school to become engineers. And then, and lo and behold, they become bomb makers. Well, engineers probably make good bomb makers. And so I wonder, would we see and a lot of them were educated in, Western universities or universities in Israel, for example, the Open University. And so I wonder, would we see, this diversification of skill sets where instead of, the smart terrorists and the leaders of the organization saying, let's go become engineers, saying, well, you know what? We need biologists and we need chemists and we need, and then, so maybe they're not, and it's not necessarily that they don't have the skills, but it's maybe they don't have these, you know, the large bio labs like in Wuhan. Maybe they're working in much smaller facilities. And it's not that, AI just gives them that extra help that they might need. But I wouldn't even necessarily blame AI for that. You know, the problem is they're going to have all the precursor agents, and they're going to have, you know, a lot of stuff that will have been produced probably by, you know, Western scientists that they then got a hold of and then sort of put the pieces together.
Yeah, that's kind of where my inclination is as well, is like, you know, even if we imagine that AI does get much better, and I should briefly note that, you know, there actually has been a number of red teaming efforts, some of which have, the results are now open source, have been published, done by RAND Corporation. I think Meta has done some. There was also, I think OpenAI did a little bit of their own, where they looked at like, okay, how much does this actually help with building these systems? And pretty much across the board, the answer has been it doesn't. At all. Like, I think in the last OpenAI had the strongest conclusion of helping, and basically there, all of the help that the AI was given was basically kind of speeding up the process, but it wasn't specific in terms of how much it sped up the process. Yeah. You know, are we talking about like you took a 10-minute task and now it's 5 minutes? Like, probably not a big deal. But I think down the road there is that potential. But to me, I come up with much the same conclusion as you, that like, is it really even if this becomes, you know, fantastically better, is it really the AI that's driving it versus the access to the precursors? Because if you can't get access to, you know, your thiodiglycol or your, you know, your Bacillus anthracis specimen, like,
or the DNA, you know, you have to buy DNA that you then, you know, manipulate, right? You're putting ferrin cleavage sites on viruses, and you're doing all this stuff, and you got to have stuff to make that happen. So, and you got to have coded genes. Yeah.
Where you start, I think where there may be a fair argument for AI being really scary is, you know, to what extent can it sort of find the ways to actually do that? And like, I struggle to imagine what this would look like in practice, but at least theoretically I could imagine there's a, you know, AI that's like, okay, here's a vulnerable facility that contains thiodiglycol. Here's why it's vulnerable. Here's how I exploit it. But even then, it's like, there's going to be so much, you know, skill that actually is directly involved that the AI can't teach you. Like, okay, let's imagine it finds the perfect facility where you can steal thiodiglycol or whatever. And it points out like, here's four different security vulnerabilities. Here's the time you need to rob it. Here's the route you need to go. Like, you still got to be able to exploit all of those things. Like, I know certainly I could not do that. I'm really nervous. I have like anxiety issues. Like, just the idea of doing that would like kind of freak me out. And there's like zero chance I wouldn't get caught, you know, by like the FBI or some other anything. You know, so the point being is like, there's still going to be these sort of skill bases that, you know, even if it becomes much, much more fantastic than it is now, you're still going to have all of those requirements that I think are difficult, really difficult to get around, and still places where, you know, government intervention and, you know, support from intelligence communities, from, you know, folks at DOD, local law enforcement, all are, you know, the aperture that we, and system that we built post 9/11 to control and, you know, these things. All of that's going to be just as relevant, you know, even if a world where this AI gets fantastically better at what it's doing.
Yeah. Now it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to sort of shift topics and move. We've been talking about AI, and you're a drone guy. So I want to talk about, I've been thinking a lot about how do we, you know, build drones that are AI enabled that can, you know, we don't need, you know, I've watched videos of Ukrainian soldiers, you know, in these FPV drones, and they're hunting down Russians, and they're, but why do you even need a human? Why aren't we building drones and just saying, hey, if you see this kind of uniform, go kill it. You see this vehicle, go kill it, and let them loose. And I would think that the Ukraine case would be a great one. So when we come back, we're going to switch topics. You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back. This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. And we're back. We're talking to Zach Kallenborn. Now, we sort of had this interesting AI discussion, and we were talking about, you know, CBERNY stuff and biological agents. But I want to take AI and now move it over to drones. And then, you know, we got to talk drones and can they kill nukes before we end the show. But have you been thinking about this and you know, sort of what's the next evolution of drones and sort of Ukraine being the proving ground for all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have quite a few articles, folks, if they're interested, can read it all on my website. So yes, I think there is a big convergence there. And both states are interested in increasingly doing this. So far, we've seen relatively limited amounts of that sort of AI drone fusion. A lot of what we've seen has been more for like terminal guidance type systems where, you know, the drone is coming in and it's, you know, maybe like 500 meters or feet or whatever away. And then it uses the AI to confirm that, oh, yes, that's actually the target that, you know, the human operator said, like, oh, that looks like that glob of pixels that the operator said, like, okay, let's make sure that I'm still, you know, hitting it in the event of jamming or other interference. And that's a big part of why folks want it, that is jamming. You know, something that we've seen in the Ukraine-Russian conflict on both sides, they're jamming each other's systems significantly, both in terms of the command and control units to, like, you know, send the drone here and there, as well as the GPS or GNSS systems used for the navigation to make sure the drone is going the same place. And so folks have been pursuing AI and general autonomy to sort of get around that, because if you don't need the human saying go over here, then that's fine. And similarly, folks are developing AI-based systems to help with the navigation support, you know, where you might have, for example, a camera that's looking at the ground around it and saying, oh, look, there's that mountain over here, there's that river over here, and then let's compare against the map inside my computer and say, okay, I must be over here. And then based on what they knew from, you know, when they had GPS access, like, okay, I know where my location now is and I know where I need to go and can go along that. So there's a lot of interest in that on both sides. Absolutely. The challenge, though, is getting a lot of that right and getting the technology to do so. Because, you know, the challenge is terrain can be so very, very different. And especially in a battlefield context where, you know, things might get blown up, you know, might have debris, you might have smoke. What happens if it's rainy or cloudy or foggy or any, you know, million different permutations that come into the place? And similarly, you know, if you're flying over water, like, there's not really any land masses to differentiate, right, you know, this pot of ocean versus this other one. So there's a lot of very real limitations. In fact, we saw with, I think it was the Russian Lancet, where that's a Russian loitering munition system that meant to kind of like fly around and look for targets. And then operator says, all right, you know, there's a tank over there, go blow it up. There was some indications that they were using it autonomously, sort of as you described, like, okay, let's look around, search for a tank, found a tank, and then just autonomously go blow it up. But then they appear to have turned it off because they found it actually didn't really work all that well. Because part of the, you know, that problem of, you know, the machines at the moment, and that's exactly what some of the issues we're hitting with some of the CBERN issues and why, you know, some of the lack of effectiveness on that is that, you know, they tend to hallucinate. They tend to make mistakes. You know, these aren't human brains yet. Maybe down in the future, maybe, you know, some folks do think, you know, we could have human level intelligence in the next few years. I'm personally skeptical about that. But there are people in the know who believe that confidently. But clearly, we're not there yet. And so that's been part of the issue, is like these potential for maintenance mistakes is not working as well as one would like. But certainly all sides, and as well as the United States and China and others, are certainly pursuing this technology very, very actively.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I would expect that exactly what we're talking about. How far in the future do you think something akin to that would be in terms of, you know, being able to be deployed?
So akin to what? Do you mean like a full, like a human level intelligence, do you mean?
Or No, not general intelligence, but just sort of having drones that have small explosives that, mm-hmm. you know, we sort of send them in a general direction and say, you know, hunt for a soldier, hunt for a tank, hunt for a, you know, and then, you know, yeah, either so come back or blow up.
Yeah, so there's multiple layers to this. So the basic technology, that's here. Absolutely. Doing it reliably in many of these contexts, that I'm less sure. And I'm not as much of a technologist myself, so I hesitate to speculate a little bit. I will speculate a little bit, but, you know, I'll give that caveat. Like, this is not, like, I don't know the down and gritty technologies that particularly well. But my general sense is, you know, at potentially multiple years. But that said, you know, we have been working on it for a while, so it's, you know, possible it's getting closer and closer. But and I was just talking to some technologists the other day who were pointing out, like, we're not really there yet. We got stuff to go. That said, you know, it's possible that some other folks figured it out and have much better approaches. I don't really know. But the larger point, though, is that the actual technology is here. Doing it reliably is more of the challenge, though.
Yeah. Now, if we're having this kind of trouble looking at tanks, you know, one of the things I sort of envision was, you know, for the U.S., part of our targeting of adversary nuclear weapons, for, you know, are mobile weapons, right? By the time we shoot something, they'll move. And therefore, we can't effectively count on destroying those adversary weapons. The North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians, they all have mobile weapons. But what if we had drones that, you know, let's say we could drop drones that looked like rocks in a, you know, sort of in an area, and then we can activate those drones and say, hey, listen, you know, if you, you know, here's what a tell and here's what the missile looks like, go find it and then, you know, get close and detonate and sort of disable it. So you've sort of answered the question that we're not necessarily quite there yet. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if for those of us, for the listeners who are, you know, predominantly in the nuclear enterprise and think about nuclear weapons, how do you see sort of the AI and drones and all of this playing together to be relevant to the nuclear enterprise in the years ahead?
Yeah. So there's a few dimensions of it. So, you know, although I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of that, you know, finding the tells and whatnot automatically, certainly one can imagine using with an operator. You know, that's going to, of course, depend on the actual state. Probably, you know, having a drone operator operating for an extended period of time in North Korea and not getting caught and killed or anything like that, probably very, very difficult. And if you can get that, you're probably only talking pretty small numbers there where you're not necessarily going to be, you know, finding all of the various systems. But that might be different in the United States. You know, I think one of the concerns that many people have is that these mystery drones that have been showing up around, you know, around ICBM sites, as well as I know there's a whole bunch in Banger Kits Up, you know, where there's a bunch of
stuff.
And, you know, that can be very, very critical, even though it's not exactly hard to locate, like, oh, where's mm-hmm. the silos, you know, you can monitor for patterns of life, look for indicators in ways that you might not necessarily otherwise, you know, because you think about like satellites passing overhead, you know, we can track those relatively well and know that, oh, you know, there's a satellite coming overhead, we better, you know, start doing this or hide this or do whatever. But you don't necessarily have that with a drone that might just be showing up at random, even in a time when normally satellites wouldn't be effective because of, you know, weather or whatnot. So I think that intelligence collection is absolutely very concerning there. And I think, you know, even if the ground environment maybe might be a bit more difficult, the undersea environment is, of course, a bit different, where you don't necessarily have as much clutter. And so you can imagine drones undersea being spread out to help search for submarines or attack them if you find them.
You know, I can imagine, you know, explosive drones literally sitting outside, you know, the sea lanes where the subs are coming out, right? They're going to have to come out of port. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that in the 1980s, there were incidents outside, you know, in Britain, and there were incidents in Russia where attack submarines from the other side were sitting there waiting for the boomers to come out. And then they picked up their sound, they followed them, and then there was a collision. Mm-hmm. So we know that subs can do that. Could you imagine the, and of course, you know, we've built efforts to try to detect that and stop that. And, you know, we've had successes there, but I can imagine, you know, much smaller drones, which therefore are much quieter, which, you know, run, you know, deep and silent could potentially be missed. And, you know, that could be a problem in and of itself. So it's air, or let's say drone swarms, right? You know, I've been to baseball games where, you know, at the baseball games, they have the drone shows and they, you know, they're a light show. But I can imagine, like, what if drone swarms were to attack, you know, launch facilities, ICBM launch facilities in, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe one drone can't destroy, you know, that blast door, that concrete door, but, you know, a swarm mite could, or all you have to do is disable it so that the, the, you know, the ICBM can't leave, you know, can't leave its launch facility. So there's, to me, there's so much potential there that is sort of, maybe if we're not there yet, but in the years ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And just introducing the uncertainty of that, you know, that can be destabilizing, you know, in and of itself, especially like in the middle of the crisis, like, do we, how well do we know? What if, like, even if it isn't necessarily like, you know, completely destroy the, or make a major issue, if there's just the uncertainty, or it's more difficult, or it costs us time, or anything of that sort would be a problem in of itself. And I think there, it's not only the drones itself, but also sort of the information processing that, you know, potentially, and the intelligence value that you can potentially get, where, you know, you have all these drones out there and they're collecting all sorts of data. And then you sort of use AI to sort of process and analyze. And maybe you might be able to find subtle signals that you might not otherwise pick up on about, like, okay, here's where the submarines are and that type of thing. Now, of course, you know, the submarine, the ocean being as vast as it is, you know, and drones being even big undersea drones being the size that they are, you know, I'm kind of skeptical that you're going to get like the real time, any sort of like real time true transparency. But I don't think that's even necessary to get generate some of these risks, you know. So like, if we imagine that we use that AI to process, we have our massive swarms of drones that are searching the ocean and, you know, looking around. That's going to generate huge amounts of data. And so we imagine that we're going to use the AI to do that. Probably that's going to take a little bit of time. And, you know, by the time that we process and analyze that, that submarine might very well be gone from where it is. So it may not be useful for like a more real-time targeting. However, you know, one could imagine that once you start picking up those signals, you can then also figure out trends within those signals. Are there any patterns of behavior that are discernible, especially in combination with other information we might know or an adversary might know about us, about doctrine, operations, behaviors, you know, other types of intelligence information, you know, because if we can start figuring out patterns, then we can start potentially anticipating where the submarine will be. And then we can validate that or reject that with future data, which then may, you know, create higher degrees of maybe not immediate transparency, but at least anticipation. And if you know where the submarine is going to be, then you can figure out where do I need my weapon systems to be, you know, and then you can create a much larger threat to that force and to that larger, you know, second strike stability.
Now we're about out of time, but I didn't want to end the show without bringing out, of course, Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp and Bob grants you three wishes about the topics we've been discussing, Zach, what is wish number one?
My wish number one is, and I think we've already gotten a little bit of this with this new AI national security memorandum, is that the U.S. government and specifically the national security complex works very closely together and develops new systems to collaborate with AI companies. I think part of the reason why I didn't like SB 1047 is very antagonistic. It's, you know, the AI companies are evil. We need to put things on, you know, maybe not literally evil, but it was, you know, it was not a collaborative relationship, I think, to build these things. And I think there needs to be that collaborative relationship on multiple levels, you know, because AI, I think, can also be really useful for our security. It's not just a threat, you know, because you can imagine using AI to improve detectors and say, you know, look for subtle signs of terrorist movement or activities, you know, especially with like massive financial data where, you know, at least certainly my eyes glaze over looking at any of that. And I'm sure even the people who do this professionally kind of glaze over sometimes, you know, but using AI to find some of those subtle signals, I think is really, really important. So I'd wish for a much greater level of collaboration. And then second, I would wish for a much more focused and directed effort on understanding all of these different risk pathways, as well as the different mechanisms to do so. So a lot of like the current red teaming work has been focusing on like, okay, let's try to like build scenarios and let's try to, you know, do it in a pure text type thing about and see how much information this can provide. But I'm not aware that anyone has really looked at like, okay, what happens if we equip it to the automated bio equipment or stuff like that? How well could, you know, folks use it in that way or like mesh it with some of these real world issues that we've talked about? I think there's a little bit of that, but, you know, not nearly enough. But I think that needs to expand and really more precisely. And then as well as and then I suppose my number third would be much better understanding of the precise risk mitigation measures. Yeah. And thinking about that entirety of that process and where those gaps are. Because there might be gaps that are related to AI, absolutely. And there might be other gaps that are very critical that actually it's not really the AI that's really the driver. I think, for example, of not really much of a CBRN issue, but I suppose a little bit, is of cyber vulnerabilities at like water treatment plants, for example. And so, okay, if an AI is able to exploit some of those cybersecurity vulnerabilities, that might actually just be that we have an issue with the water facility and that we have a cybersecurity issue rather than an AI issue, especially if what the AI is doing is just, you know, searching broadly for vulnerabilities rather than coming up with some novel like malware or something like that. Like it might be that the issue actually has nothing to do with AI. So being, you know, considering that full scope of risk pathways and or risk mitigation pathways and options, I think I would absolutely wish for it.
All right. Three good wishes. Zach Hallenborn, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, Zach is always interesting, so I don't know about you, but I really enjoyed that discussion. You know, trying to pull those threads, you know, where you take multiple technologies and think about how can they be used together. You know, that's one of those things that we have to think through. And it's always sort of interesting to see what is the difference between where, you know, what we can think of and where we actually are, and to kind of effectively measure that distance. So talking about that's always good. It's always good to hear from Zach.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.